Thank you very much, Steve. So a couple of people have asked me to explain the title. It's a fairly sort of public schoolish allusion to 1066 and all that, where kings all die of surfeits of this, that, and the other, and I sometimes feel as though I've had enough naturalism. Thank you very much. So what I want to do in this slot is think about the role that science plays in philosophy and the role that science ought to play in philosophy, and I'm going to specifically be focusing on philosophy of science, although I'll look at the relationship between science and other areas of philosophy too at various points. Now, I find myself in some sympathy with Fraser in a kind of skepticism about abstract methodological reflections on philosophy. Instead, I think that the sort of the Nike approach is better sometimes to, you know, just do it, as they say. So what I'll try to do this afternoon is just offer a few vignettes of ways in which I think science can and can't be used effectively in philosophical argumentation. Maybe before I get onto that, I should give you a few kind of autobiographical details. So as Steve says, I'm at the moment in the History and Philosophy of Science department, but I don't think that I'm going to be offering a distinctively HPS type view of what sort of a thing philosophy ought to be. I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm probably not the best judge, so maybe you can tell me afterwards. I did my undergraduate degree here in Cambridge in the Faculty of Philosophy, and I also did my MPhil in the philosophy faculty here as well. I was nursed largely on a kind of heady, explosive cocktail of Hugh Mellor on metaphysics and Michael Tanner on Nietzsche. Not a particularly natural kind for those of you who are familiar with those two. And if you're not familiar with them, then Tim Crane will do great impersonations of both later on. I can only do Michael. I can't do Hugh so well. So anyway, and then I didn't arrive in HPS until I started my PhD, and then I kind of came under the influence of particularly Nick Jardine and Peter Lipton. But it may be possible that my kind of earlier philosophical training will shine through in this talk. So as far as the philosophy of science goes, there are two related themes which in recent years have increasingly become dominant. One of them is a comparative demise of what's sometimes called general philosophy of science, i.e. philosophical approaches to allegedly general questions in the sciences regarding explanation, laws of nature, and so forth, in favor of a more fragmented focus on philosophical questions that arise in particular sciences. So philosophical issues in physics, in biology, in psychology, and even in recent years, there's been increasing interest in philosophy of chemistry, believe it or not. And then every now and then people propose conferences and you wonder whether it's really a joke. So when someone says, we're organizing a meeting on the philosophy of geology, you have to kind of ask yourself, is this serious or not? And it turns out it is serious. Another theme, though, is an almost universal endorsement, I think, among philosophers of science of a position which is known as naturalism. Now, naturalism is understood in various different ways in various different philosophical traditions. But I think at least for philosophers of science in recent years, although by no means for everybody, naturalism has tended to involve the following sorts of themes. The entry-level theme is a focus on science as the best source of knowledge of nature. Okay, sometimes just the best, sometimes the only source of knowledge, full stop. This often leads the proponents of naturalism onto a second theme. The thought goes, if science really is the best source of knowledge, then philosophical claims should always be extremely deferential to claims of scientists. And then the sort of the converse of that is it turns out to be a badge of honor for philosophical theories, a great plus point for philosophical theories, if they are rich in highly detailed scientific information, if they make clear sense of scientific claims. And this then sometimes leads to a third theme, and this is perhaps the most extreme element of this naturalistic package. The thought is that non-scientific methods should be treated with extreme suspicion. So when one comes to do philosophy, abstract metaphysics of an a priori nature should be rejected. The use in philosophical thinking of imaginary cases generated from the armchair should be frowned upon. And conceptual analysis of various kinds is a thoroughly misguided project. So the basic thought here is that the traditional way in which philosophy proceeds, it stays in the armchair using largely made-up examples, is something to be got rid of. Now, I have some sympathy with some of these strands of naturalism. I mean, maybe the easiest way to put this is that I do worry that sometimes philosophical theories are too insouciant of findings of the natural sciences. So here are just a couple of examples. First of all, one from recent ethical theory, particularly from meta-ethics. Theorists like Philippa Foote and Michael Thompson have both, in slightly different ways, endorsed forms of Aristotelianism in ethics, which have become quite influential. So Philippa Foote's idea is that moral evil is, as she puts it, a kind of natural defect. And the basic idea that Foote seems to have is that an evil person has got something defective about them. What's defective about them is their practical reasoning, just like a wobbly oak tree has got something defective about it, and what's defective about it is something to do with its roots not being made right. And Foote seems to think in both kinds of cases, when we judge someone as evil or when we judge an oak tree as defective, we just make simple judgments of fact. Now, I don't particularly have any issue with Foote's claim that we often make what look on the surface like perfectly factual judgments about defective traits in both plants and animals all the time. And I also don't have any particular issue with the thought that these judgments on the face of things make reference to standards of flourishing for the species in question. But what I do worry about, and I'm not going to particularly argue for this here, given considerations of time, I do worry simply that current biology does not provide any facts which might serve to ground these alleged standards of flourishing. And I also think that recent work in psychology suggests that we are indeed perhaps innately apt to think of species as having essential natures. Now, if you combine those together, you get a very different kind of picture to the one that Foote endorses. Biology and psychology together, you might think, naturally point towards a kind of error theory. We mistakenly believe, in virtue of our psychological makeup, that species have the sorts of essential natures that would then enable us to make judgments of the kind that Thompson and Foote have alerted us to. But this doesn't serve their ethical theory particularly well. Consider another case, the political philosopher Michael Sandel has fairly recently tried to formulate a sort of measured opposition to the use of various enhancement technologies, including genetic enhancements. Sandel thinks that it's perfectly reasonable, of course, to use medical technologies of various kinds when they, in his words, permit a child's natural capacities to flourish. But what Sandel says is that we should not, again in his words, override that child's natural capacities. But then the problem comes when you start to reflect on real examples. Think of a child who is born with the disease phenylketonuria, usually abbreviated to PKU. So PKU genes have a detrimental effect on cognitive development, but it turns out that this detrimental effect can be greatly reduced if the child is given a special diet, and that diet needs to be low in a commonly occurring amino acid called phenylalanine. And they need to be given that special diet very early. So one of the great things about the Guthrie test is it catches kids very, very early indeed, and you can get them on the special diet very quickly. So what are we supposed to say here if we put a child on this special diet? Have we overridden the child's natural capacities by giving them this special diet? Well, presumably Sandel wants to say no. Presumably Sandel wants to say no. This kind of intervention counts as simply allowing the child's natural capacities to flourish. But then you say, well, what do you mean then when you talk about what the child's natural capacities are? Do you just mean any old capacities that the child could attain given the right interventions? The problem with that, of course, is it won't serve as any kind of break on genetic enhancement. Of course, you could try to retrench and say, look, something like genetic alteration, if that changes a child's ultimate phenotype, doesn't count as a natural process, and so for that reason you can't describe genetic modification as allowing a person's natural capacities to flourish. But then the problem arises, well, what do you mean by natural? It seems to be just as implausible to think that a specially designed diet low in phenylalanine of the sort that is given to PKU kids is natural. That seems to be just as unnatural as genetic alteration. So the worry is that there just doesn't seem to be any kind of biologically respectable notion of natural capacities that can do the job that Sandel needs, and for that reason I'm sceptical of Sandel's efforts to oppose genetic enhancement. Okay, so I think there are occasions when biological thinking can reasonably be brought to bear on philosophical positions. But I also think that many naturalists go too far, and I want to spend the rest of this talk elaborating the ways in which naturalists, I think, overstep themselves. So, first of all, I think the virtues of attending to detailed claims within specific scientific theories can sometimes be considerably exaggerated. I don't think philosophers should turn their backs on abstract tools from mainstream metaphysics or epistemology, because sometimes it can just lead them to fail to see the wood for the trees. So here, apologies, I'm going to draw on a fairly recent book review that I wrote, which I know at least a couple of you have already read. So in a recent book, very much in line with the sort of naturalism that I'm criticising, philosopher of science Sandra Mitchell has made the following complaint about how philosophers have tended to think about causation. And what she has, again, in her sights is that philosophers have thought about causation too much from the armchair, and they haven't kind of got their hands dirty by thinking about real scientific cases. Mitchell says, traditional philosophical analyses of the cleanest, clearest cases of causal interactions, perhaps the first step in philosophical analyses of science, are difficult, if not impossible, to apply to the messy, murky causal relations that are displayed by genes and phenotypes, human interventions on the global climate, or multi-level feedback-laden phenomena studies in modern psychiatry. Now, part of the question of whether that's justified will depend on what you think Mitchell means when she talks about these so-called traditional philosophical analyses, and she doesn't really say very much about that. But presumably, if anything's traditional, David Lewis's theory of counterfactuals, David Lewis's counterfactual theory of causation is a traditional view of causation put forward in 1973, and then taught to undergraduate students, also constructed very much from Lewis's own armchair, and also defended from the armchairs of subsequent graduate students. Now, the very kind of basic gist of Lewis's view is very, very simple. To say that C causes E is just to say that if C hadn't occurred, E wouldn't have done. Now, I mean, one very immediate thought is that Lewis's account makes room for all sorts of messy, murky causal relations that Mitchell seems to be concerned about. It makes room for all kinds of complexity. And that's just because some forms of complexity, some forms of mess and murkiness, are obvious enough to everybody that we don't need to get out of our armchairs to realise that an account must make room for them. So, for example, if you say, what effect does pulling the trigger of a gun have? That obviously depends on local contextual factors, such as whether there's anybody standing at the end of the gun or not, and it obviously depends on the contingencies of starting conditions, like whether or not anybody happened to put a bullet into the chamber. Okay. And Lewis's account can make is perfectly compatible with all of these thoughts. Now, that doesn't mean that we can intuit from the armchair precisely which natural systems show which forms of complexity and when. Okay. So an example that Mitchell uses, a very interesting example, she tells us a little bit about how genes get together in development to produce adult organisms, how this transition occurs from fertilized egg to adult. And it turns out that genes interact, they form various kinds of networks, and these networks have what Mitchell terms robustness, and what developmental geneticists will often term robustness, built into them. What this means is that if you take a gene that has a particular kind of causal impact on development, you can remove it from the system, and then what happens is that the system kind of reconfigures itself so that the normal developmental outcome gets produced all the same, even when the initially causally active gene is missing. Hence, robustness. So the system is kind of robust to various elements being removed or tampered with. Now, what this means, Mitchell kind of raises a methodological point, what this means is that you can't necessarily figure out what the causal role of a given gene is by performing a so-called knockout technique. And a knockout technique involves removing the gene in question to see what happens. Mitchell's point is that because we know actually that these systems have a form of robustness built into them, you take the gene out and the overall system still does the same thing as it did anyway in virtue of that robustness. Now, one thing that means, you might think, okay, so why do those kinds of things show problems for traditional philosophical accounts of causation? Well, you might say something like, what they show is that counterfactual accounts of causation don't work, okay? Because by hypothesis, a given gene has an effect, and if you say, what would happen were we to remove the gene? Answer, just the same thing would happen as before. It's not the case that were the gene to be removed, the outcome wouldn't occur. Okay, so you might say what this shows is that reflection on these murky, messy cases shows the inadequacy of the counterfactual account. But that would be a terrible argument, because people like Lewis knew perfectly well that the counterfactual account needed to be modified, needed to be looked after in order to encompass similar kinds of robustness. But Lewis didn't need to look at real-life cases from biology in order to show this. Lewis used to use examples generated from the armchair. Okay? So Lewis would say, think about this kind of case. Bill fires a gun and he kills the president. Bob also has a gun trained on the president, and because he doesn't trust Bill and thinks Bill is kind of unreliable, he's resolved that he'll fire his gun as well if Bill's nerve fails him. So then we say, well, had Bill not fired, the president would still have died, okay? Because Bob would have shot him instead. But Lewis will say, look, a good account of causation has to deliver the right answer in these cases. It has to deliver the result that Bill does indeed kill the president, is indeed the cause of the death, even though the counterfactual doesn't straightforwardly seem to come out right. Now, I don't want to go into any detail about precisely how Lewis goes about solving that problem. The point is simply that these sorts of robustness, the general phenomena of causal robustness, seem to be perfectly visible to philosophers, even from the armchair. You don't need the kind of messy, murky cases that Mitchell draws on in order to realise that redundancy is something that a philosophical account of causation needs to allow for. I have a second worry about naturalism. I think this is the more serious worry, really. There was a theme which seemed to crop up quite a lot last summer at the British Society for the Philosophy of Science conference. And one would constantly hear speakers saying that, partly because of their great respect for science, that they did not want to think of themselves as preaching to scientists. They would not preach to scientists. And it seems that the line of thinking goes, look, scientific methods give us our best ways of finding out about the world. Philosophical methods don't really have anything distinctive to add to these methods. And so philosophers don't really have anything distinctive to offer to scientists by ways of correctives. And that's why philosophers shouldn't be in the business of preaching to scientists. They frankly don't have anything to teach them. And the end result of this, I think, is that a lot of philosophy of science can become rather unphilosophical. It ends up looking more like high-end science journalism, basically, where the philosopher simply finds out a whole bunch of interesting facts that scientists have published and then repackages them in a way that other philosophers find digestible, while then simply declining to comment on any kind of grand themes of philosophy. So why shouldn't, why shouldn't philosophers preach to scientists at least every now and then? If you thought that philosophers should never preach to scientists, or that philosophers should always defer to the pronouncements of scientists, I mean, it seems as though the only thing that could possibly make sense of that position would be the thought either that when scientists themselves say things, their claims are always entirely free of philosophy, or that if they do have philosophy in them, scientists are just much better at doing philosophy than all philosophers are. And it doesn't seem to me that either of those claims is remotely sustainable. So, a kind of very quick example, Michael Geeslin, who's a biologist, has for a long time said that biologists in general have misunderstood the sorts of things that species are. They've thought that species are natural kinds, like gold, rather than individuals like this particular table. And Geeslin says once they get the metaphysics straight, then a lot of problems about species will disappear or become soluble. Now here, Geeslin, even as a biologist, is explicitly entering into a philosophical debate. And he claims that biologists have always been implicitly involved in that philosophical debate as well, even if they haven't necessarily realised it. Now, if Geeslin is anything like right here, biologists themselves are already saddled with philosophical commitments, whether they like it or not. And it also seems to me that sometimes scientists are committed to philosophical positions which are just silly positions, and there's no problem correcting them. So, I mean, here's a particularly extreme example. A sociobiologist called Richard Alexander. Alexander claims, and he takes this as kind of self-evident, quote, all of life function is understandable as reproductive, and then he goes on to say, genetic reproduction really is the evolutionary end-all. And that general stance on evolution then leads him to make the following claim about moral psychology. He says, it's difficult to imagine that anyone invests in the stock market for altruistic reasons. Perhaps no one invests in anything at all except relatives without expecting, not necessarily consciously, phenotypic rewards that include some kind of interest on the investment. Now, here when Alexander talks about reasons for investing in the stock market, he seems to quite strongly suggest that, on his view, parents who invest in the stock market in order simply to ease the financial future of their own children really only care about themselves rather than about the interests of their offspring. And when he talks about reasons not necessarily being conscious, he at least seems to allude to the thought that maybe unconsciously our financial investments are based on some kind of selfish psychological expectation. So that, for example, directors of charities never truly invest in order that the return might be used to benefit others. But nothing at all in a view of human psychological traits, even as a product of a struggle between fitness-maximizing genes, entails any of these propositions about motivation or unconscious motivation. And so it seems to me that there's really nothing wrong with preaching a bit to scientists when they're like Alexander. In the time that remains, I want to give some... And here I'm going kind of well away from my usual area of... I don't want to say expertise, my usual area, by just offering a few thoughts about another trend in recent naturalistic philosophy. So I mentioned at the beginning that a lot of philosophers of science of a naturalistic turn think that conceptual analysis is a waste of time. And again, they want to replace anything that looks like a philosophical method with something that looks much more like a good old-fashioned scientific method, where one goes and does experiments. And philosophers do spend their time saying things like, we would all agree that, it is intuitively obvious that, okay? And there's a trend in philosophy that says, are you sure we'd all agree? Have you asked anybody? And it's, what do you mean it's intuitive? It might be intuitive to you, but, it almost certainly wouldn't be intuitive to John. So the thought is, you know, you need to go and get rid of conceptual analysis and do some experimental work instead. And so this is the movement known as the experimental philosophy movement, or somewhat nauseatingly, the X-Fi movement. I suspect because they all want to be on Star Wars. So let me just say a few things about what's probably the most widely discussed case in the experimental philosophy movement, and it's to do with intention. So here's what you might think, or at least what some people have thought based on what they do in their armchairs. The thought is, if some kind of outcome is merely a so-called side effect of your actions, then it's not something that you do intentionally, even if it is something that you might foresee prior to its occurrence. Okay, and this is the way that things have intuitively looked quite a few philosophers. So, a kind of example, I can foresee that the soles of my shoes will wear down if I walk around. Okay, but while I might be walking around intentionally, I'm not wearing down the soles of my shoes intentionally. It's a foreseen side effect, but not something I do intentionally. That's at least the thought that a lot of people have. And as I say, that seems to be the kind of the armchair view that many people have arrived at. But things start to look a little bit different when you get out of your armchair and instead you walk around in Central Park. So a philosopher called Josh Knobe wandered around Central Park asking people what they thought about these kinds of cases. So Knobe gave people this scenario. It's not to do with shoes, it's to do with making money in a company. So apologies, if I'd been better organised, I would have got this on an overhead for you or something. So I'll just try and read it fairly slowly. So this is the vignette, as Knobe calls it, that he gives people. And this has now been reproduced over and over again in many discussions of the so-called Knobe effect. The vice president of a company went to the chairman of the board and said, "We are thinking of starting a new program. It will help us increase profits, but it will also harm the environment." The chairman of the board answered, "I don't care at all about harming the environment." I always feel tempted to do this in a kind of cod American accent. I don't care at all about harming the environment. I just want to make as much profit as I can. Let's start the new program. They started the new program. Sure enough, the environment was harmed. Okay, end of vignette. Now, it turns out, perhaps surprisingly, that most people, 82% of people, said, which makes me 82%, that gives, might give you some kind of clue about how many people he actually interviewed, I don't know. 82% of people said that the chairman intentionally harmed the environment. Okay. Now, one of the other interesting things is that if you don't represent the chairman as not caring about a harmful effect that subsequently transpires, but instead you represent him as not caring about an effect of a profit-making program that will help the environment that subsequently transpires, then most people judge that the chairman does not act intentionally in helping the environment. Okay. Now, so what, you might say, right? So what if people think about things in this way? Well, the thought seems to be something like this. The whole point is, it's written into the vignette, it's written into Knobe's vignette, that the chairman, quote, doesn't care about harming the environment. He's told us he doesn't care about that, he just wants to make profits. So it's stipulated that environmental harm is just a side effect, but most people judge that it's something the chairman does intentionally. Okay. And the fact that they judge this to be done intentionally seems to depend on the fact that the scheme happens to be damaging rather than helpful. Now, of course, Knobe's scenario doesn't literally stipulate that environmental damage is a side effect of the chairman's desire for profit. But consumers of the case, consumers of the vignette, are supposed to, or at least I presume alleged to believe, that environmental damage is a side effect, because they are told that it's profit, not environmental damage, that the chairman, quote, cares about, right? Now, there's been, as I say, an awful lot of discussion of this so-called Knobe effect, and I don't want to try to give anything like, nor am I competent to give anything like an exhaustive survey here. I mean, I think Knobe's experiment is kind of suggestive. It's interesting. It's worth listening to and thinking about. But it doesn't establish all that much about what people think the link might be between side effects and intentionally produced behaviours. Because, for example, maybe, I mean, for all that Knobe's told us, maybe what goes on is something like this. Maybe people hear that the chairman, quote, doesn't care about harming the environment. What they then do is they create an image of the chairman as a kind of wanton character, and they infer from that that he's probably the kind of guy who damaged the environment on purpose if there's profit to be had. And conversely, when they're instead told in the other version of the vignette that the chairman doesn't care about helping the environment, they also create an image of the chairman as a kind of wanton character who probably also isn't the kind of person who'd go about trying to improve the environment on purpose either, which would then account for why they say it is intentional in the harm case and it isn't in the helping case. Now, perhaps strangely, that interpretation seems to be actually compatible with Knobe's own very recent work. Okay. So in Knobe's much more recent work, he suggests maybe what goes on is most people, and again, this is kind of based on some experimental stuff he's done, he suggests maybe most people think of environmental damage as the sort of thing that you just shouldn't be neutral about. Okay? You're meant to be opposed to environmental damage. You're not supposed to be neutral about it. And so since the chairman's stated attitude to environmental damage, namely the claim he doesn't care about it, although you might think strictly that's neutral, it's more in favour of environmental damage than the default of opposition that we're supposed to adopt. And so because of that, he's interpreted as wanting, intending, or desiring the damage in question. Now, one worry about this is that if all of this stuff is right, it may well suggest that people don't really think in this kind of case that environmental damage really is a side effect at all, in spite of Knobe's efforts in the scenario to attempt to stipulate things to the contrary. Okay. Maybe what most people think is that environmental damage is simply an intended means to the end of making profit. So a big worry then is that these sorts of experiments, although suggestive, although they might provoke some further philosophical reflection, they don't really overturn or indeed decide one way or another anything very much about philosophical views produced from the armchair. Now, I mean, I gave one interpretation of what might be going on in these cases. That might not be what happens. I mean, maybe Knobe's initial characterization of this is really correct, and maybe most people really do have the view that X, some effect X, can sometimes be done intentionally even when it's just a side effect. Now, if that's right, if Knobe's right about this, it seems to me that what you'd need to do is to think about how to articulate that view, how to justify it, how to explain what kind of a view it is that says that X can be done intentionally while it's also a side effect. Now, one problem then is that that sort of articulation and justification seem to be just the kinds of things that go on when a philosopher defends an account of intention from the armchair. So they're just the sorts of things that seem to bother Miss Anscombe in her armchair when she wondered about the following case. She worried about whether or not a servant intentionally poisons the occupants of a household when the servant knowingly pumps poisoned water into the house, in spite of the fact that he tells us, in Anscombe's words, that he, quote, didn't care tuppence one way or the other for the fact that someone had poisoned the water. I just wanted to earn my pay. Surprisingly close to the Knobe's own scenario. It seems to me, then, that experimental data in these cases have a kind of useful heuristic function, but they certainly don't stitch the debate up for good. So let me offer just some very kind of closing, platitudinous, bland comments on the naturalistic project in general. I think a sort of tempered, probably vacuous version of naturalism is what we should aim at. So I do think, as I've suggested right at the beginning, that scientific claims are perfectly valuable resources for philosophers. They can indeed discipline philosophical theorising, and they can also act as a good heuristic for further philosophical theorising. But I don't think there's any good reason to think that scientific claims are the only sorts of claims that could have this function. So good philosophical theories should ideally be mindful of the best work in all sorts of fields, from history to literary studies, it seems to me. But I also think that just as philosophers' claims can sometimes be disciplined by the sorts of things that scientists say, scientists' claims can be disciplined by the sorts of things that philosophers say too. It's one of the functions of looking at people like Alexander, for example. I suppose the way I think of philosophy is that at least one good role for it is a sort of integrative one. So I think of naturalism, a sort of worthwhile form of naturalism, as a sort of eclectic critical naturalism which uses and scrutinizes resources from a whole range of areas of investigation. And then kind of in response to some of Alexis's more expansive questions that he prompted this conference with, one hopes that that way, you know, philosophy will make the world a better place to live in. Okay. Thank you.